The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
This is Mike Consul. Welcome to the program. Our guest is Ivy Zelman. She has been on the program once before, but that was about 2 years ago, and all was hunky-dory in the housing market. Today, real estate and the housing market are under pressure from the coronavirus pandemic, or is it? Is that really true for the housing market? And if so, how bad is it really? We're going to find out about that and some other questions because there's nobody who really spends any more time researching and evaluating the health and well-being of the U.S. housing market than Ivy Zelman. Housing investors pay her a pretty penny for the data and insight she generates, but today you're going to get a dose of her information for free because she has joined the program to talk about the current state of the housing market and just where we might be headed. Ivy Zelman, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back on your show.
So let's jump right into it. True or false, the housing market is doomed. This is sans pandemic, regardless of the pandemic. True or false, the housing market is doomed because the millennial generation does not want to buy homes.
Absolutely false. The housing market is actually booming, even during the COVID pandemic, and was booming prior to the pandemic.
So millennials do actually want to become homeowners, and you're seeing that trend happening right now. Are you seeing that move being afoot?
Absolutely. In fact, if you look at total mortgage purchase origination data, about 50% of it are people that are 35 or younger in total. And we've been seeing this phenomena now for the last, call it, 5 years. And if you look at home ownership rates, and depending on, you know, breaking down by cohort in a moment, I will tell you, but just looking at overall home ownership rates, we had 1Q and 2Q overall substantial increases in home ownership rate. In fact, 1Q was up over 100 basis points, driven by the youngest cohorts. So 2Q, we estimate, will be roughly up as much or not, if not more, even with the pandemic, because the starter home market is where we see the strongest demand right now.
Wow. Okay. So it just took millennials a little bit of time, get a little older, and here they go, jumping into the housing market. And you mentioned mortgage rates. So mortgage rates are at record lows. But the hard part for a lot of people is the down payment. That can be hard to accumulate for a new homeowner. So what do you see as the affordability equation given these two, I would call them two opposing forces?
Well, let's first just to go back to the millennials for a moment. I think it's important for people to appreciate that the average millennial is now in their mid-30s, and really what drives the decision to buy is not about mortgage rates. It's more about lifestyle. And when millennials start forming families and they have more than, you know, one or two children, they need a lot more space. In fact, our data shows that 82% of married couples with two or more children between the ages of 25 and 39 actually live in a single family home. So really family formation is the key catalyst, and we are seeing people in their 30s having babies again. So, but to go to your mortgage rate question, you know, think about the fact that, you know, mortgage rates are not only now down, call it 80 basis points year over year at currently roughly 3% 30-year fixed, making it incredibly affordable. I call it mortgage rates are trumping COVID-19, but the, you know, FHA only requires a 3.5% down payment in order to buy a starter home or anything within the FHA loan limit. So while people are at home and they're, you know, working remotely in some cases, or they have one spouse that maybe is on unemployment benefits, they're not spending on their typical types of activities, whether it be traveling, entertainment, going to restaurants, baseball games, whatever, hospitality. There's so much money that they're saving that savings rates are actually up significantly. But people are really reallocating those dollars, whether otherwise in normal times would have been spent in all the categories I mentioned. They're focusing on their homes. And I'd say that housing has taken center stage People are looking around in the rooms of their home they're currently in or their apartments, and they're recognizing that I can buy a home, pay less than a mortgage payment than I would renting, and we're seeing unbelievable demand. If you saw our monthly surveys, which we survey several hundred builders a month, and we equating to about 15% of new home sales, in May, home sales were up 33% per our survey, and then in June, they were up 64%. In fact, Meritage, who reported earnings, one of the large public builders, indicated that in a city like Dallas and the suburbs, actually showed that you can buy a home and pay $1,800 a month with principal and interest compared to the same sort of square footage for a rental at $2,700 a month. So a substantial savings for consumers. So mortgage rates are trumping COVID-19, as I said, and I think that people want higher quality space. They want distance from densely populated cities. And the fact that you can work remote now, most employers are providing flexibility, including myself as an employer. People want to have optionality. They now can reduce commutes and maybe only go to the office once or twice a week, so they're willing to go further out, which is a trend that was already well underway before the pandemic, but now it's on steroids. So we're seeing a shift to the burbs, what we call the exurbs, and the suburbs from the urban core. And we're seeing a shift from high-cost cities to low-cost cities in other parts of the country where you have more favorable climates, lower taxes. So there's a lot of good things, Mike, going on in the housing market right now for at least the for sale new home market as well as retail. Not so great for the rental market.
So people have been saying over and over again about urbanization. Urbanization is just a thematic investing trend all over the world. But what you're saying is now we're seeing a reversal of that fortune, so to speak. People are actually de-urbanizing to some degree. They want the space. And is part of the drive there that obviously you can get more space if you get out of a downtown area. You get a yard and whatnot, if that's what you're looking for. But is it also because this trend towards not just, well, it sounds like a lot of employers are going to say, look, work at home, it's okay. We can do this permanently. We see people are productive. We're working very well. In fact, maybe we even save a little money by reducing our office footprint. Is that part of what's driving it, as well as just the need for some space for the children and all?
Absolutely. But just keep in mind that starting in about 2015, according to the Brookings Institute, we have data that shows that population growth rates started to decel in the urban core and were accelerating in the suburban, exurban markets. And when I say exurbs, that's really the third ring of a market. And that rate of deceleration for the urban core actually is pretty much now accelerated because of the pandemic. So it was already a shift underway, because the whole idea is that, you know, people are, again, the aging into that lifestyle decision. So this is now accelerated even more so. And everything you said about deurbanization, you know, whether that's going to be sustained once we get a vaccination and people, you know, still have the optionality of maybe not commuting every day of the week, I think the shift is going to continue, maybe not to the same magnitude once we have a vaccination, because people like living in the city or they're not planning on having children. But I think it's accelerated those people that are living in the city that do want to start a family maybe earlier than maybe they would have otherwise planned. So I think it's going to happen, but as I mentioned, it's already been underway. And if you flip the same type of information and try to look at what's been going on with, you know, the number of people that are moving out to the exurbs, that phenomena has been accelerating since 2015, and only because, Mike, builders finally got the memo, if you build it, they will come, because they weren't willing to go to the third ring because they got so severely burned by building in the third ring and overbuilding during the great housing boom. So it took them several years to really recognize that there was enough demand that if you built it, they would come. And this country right now is at the lowest number of homes available for sale on record, going back since the data has been recorded. And post the pandemic, inventories are down, hitting a new record because they were already at a record, down another 25 to 30%. So it's incredible how tight the market is. And people ask me all the time, well, why is it so tight? Why are inventories so tight, even prior to the pandemic? Well, first, with the pandemic, sellers took their homes off the market because they didn't want to have people, you know, tromping through their homes, potentially giving them the virus. But prior to the pandemic, inventories were at an all-time record low. And the reason for that was really several, which I'm happy to elaborate on, but I can stop there and take a breath. But I'm happy to tell you that the most important slide that I present to my industry executives that I interact with, as well as my institutional investors, private equity, anyone who I interact with, I'll overwhelm them sometimes with so much information, and they'll say, okay, Ivy, well, what's the most important slide in your deck? And it's the inventories as a percent of households is the most important slide in our deck, because the inventories are so, so tight, and that's what's driving home price inflation and will continue to drive home price inflation even in a world with COVID-19.
I want to get to inventories, but first let's talk about the rings. You talked about the third ring. I think you said the exurbs are the third ring. What are the rings? Go through the rings.
So the core, the urban core, is your A location. At what I'd call the second ring would be your suburban markets, and that would be your kind of B location. And then your third ring would be your C location or your exurbs. So you kind of go exurbs, suburbs, urban core.
So the third, so exurbs are actually farther out than the suburbs. That's another ring out.
Yeah.
And that's
correct. That would be the furthest out. It has historically been the least desirable. And when you're in a downturn and in a recession, the further out, what they say, they term it, mortgage originators call it drive to qualify. People don't want to go that far out because there becomes opportunities closer in. But in this world right now, you're seeing more rural markets actually further away, further from, you know, other people and larger parcels where you can have, you know, significant privacy are actually thriving right now more so than ever. But even prior to the pandemic, the exurbs were actually growing in terms of population growth rate. But the only reason it was growing is because they had a place to live, because builders were finally pioneering again, and they were finally building homes in the exurbs, because you can't have population growth in the third ring if builders weren't willing to build houses.
Well, there's a couple to begin with. The builders weren't the only ones that didn't get the memo. There's a lot of people who are still stuck on urbanization, it seems like. I mean, maybe they haven't been buying the right data from certain organizations. I didn't know about the Brookings Institution report, but the Economist magazine did a major report about 12 to 18 months ago about U.S. housing. And one of the points it made was that the United States is dreadfully underhoused, that the cities are not allowing builders to build, basically. They're making it so difficult, and they're limiting them to such an extent that there's not enough housing. And of course, the small inventory drives prices up. Does that ring true to you?
Well, I think it's fair to say that there's definitely some no-growth moratoriums depending on what city you're in. And, you know, generally speaking, you know, it's blue states that tend to be more against growth. But if you look across the country, we're seeing tremendous growth in the third ring in many, many parts of the world, like in Arizona, in Nevada, in Texas, in the Carolinas, in Tennessee, in Florida. And just to pull it up for you, just to give you some order of magnitude, if you look at the number of the homes that in 2015, the size of the median square foot that a builder built was about 2,600 plus square feet. Right now, that's declined to about 2,200 square feet. So builders are building, smaller homes, getting the average price point within the FHA loan limit. So if you go back to 15, another data point, if you looked at the percent of specs that were eligible for FHA financing in 2015, and we scrape off of builders' websites several thousand homes every month to look at how many of their homes are going to fall within FHA loan limit and how many of them, where they're priced. So in 15, 43% were eligible for FHA financing. First quarter of 20, it was 68%. So this was a strategy that the builders finally started to recognize, that there's tremendous demand, and they've been building homes in the 150, 200s, 250s, and home ownership rates are going up substantially. And by the way, home ownership rates are the strongest rate of growth is going to shock you, are for people under 25 years old. Now, keep in mind, those under 25 are starting at a much lower base. So the percentage increase is from a lower base is about a 23% home ownership rate for those under 25. But those aged 25 to 29 have the second strongest rate of growth. and their home ownership rate is about 30%. So even the 30 to 34-year-olds, it grew only about 50 basis points for 1Q. But, people that, in terms of home ownership rates, have a very high home ownership rate. So this is what we have to contemplate, which is a 50% home ownership rate. So each of them are growing off of different size bases, but it's just been because builders are finally willing to provide the product that the market's been being starved for. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, these young people, my God, 25 years old, they usually, what they want to begin with, they couldn't afford homes before, it seemed like. What they wanted was a lock and rock. Give me an apartment. I can lock it. I can go to Tahoe for the weekend. I can do whatever. I don't have to worry about my yard care, watering plants and what have you. Are parents basically bankrolling this? And why are young people so interested in actually owning now? A lot of them don't like to be encumbered. At least it used to be that way.
I think what, in our opinion, it wasn't different this time. I think that people went through the great housing bust. They watched their parents get burned severely. Young adults, 18 to 34, had very high unemployment rates, much higher than the national averages. They approached 14%, and they had massive student loan debt. There was so much struggling that they weathered and had to deal with that coming out of this Great Recession, it took them much longer to recover than overall employment and overall households. But when they get to that age where they're ready to finally settle down and have a significant other and start a family, we don't believe anything's changed. It's just, they just delayed those things. They delayed marriage. They delayed having children. But now that they're in their middle to late 30s and they're having babies again, they want the same thing you and I wanted, Mike, when we were growing up. They want to have the backyard. They want the American dream. And they can afford it. And they can come up with a down payment. Now, yes, there are parents and family members that are providing support to help people get them in through the down payment. And we hear it from mortgage originators. We survey about 20% of the mortgage market through a monthly mortgage survey. And, anecdotally, it's as high as like 25 to 40% receive some type of support, gifting them some support towards the gift to the down payment. But I do think that because you're not spending as much right now on all those other areas I spoke to, whether it's entertainment, sports, travel, vacation, restaurants, dining, you're saving up and willingly putting all that money now towards the down payment. And that's where you're seeing. Now, that may change, admittedly, which is why we're not expecting and forecasting new home sales to increase at the 64% pace indefinitely. We expect, new home sales to increase modestly up mid-single digits throughout the rest of 20 and into 21, low to mid-single digits. But it doesn't take a lot to move the needle, even with, 20% of the, today employed base unemployed or unemployment being at 20%. So I think you have to also recognize that there was a major tailwind to the urban market. The number of 20 to 34-year-olds was actually accelerating in terms of population growth rate throughout the great housing boom and bust throughout. Until roughly 2015, there was tremendous growth in the number of 20 to 34-year-olds. So it was quite a tailwind for the urban market. And urban development was just, growing like weeds and the wall of capital chasing the asset class. Well, now by the end of 2030, the number of 20 to 34-year-olds will actually be negative and will decline through this decade through to the end of 2030. Whereas on the flip side, part of the problem in the recovery of the housing market is that the year-over-year number of people between the ages of 35 and 44 were actually declining through the housing bust, putting pressure on the demand side for single family and family formation. But now it's going to accelerate between 2020 and 2030. You're going to add about 5 to 6 million more people ages 35 to 44. So it's an unbelievable tailwind. Really, tides have turned, and the urban core has the headwinds, and the suburban, exurb markets have unbelievable tailwinds.
Okay, so the economics and psychology is changing here. So follow my scenario. I'm a home builder. And true or false, the woman's going to make the, if a couple comes in to buy one of my homes, the woman's going to make the decision ultimately.
True.
Knowing that, what room or rooms must I emphasize in my design and spacing to win that the average American woman over and get her to just say, this is my home?
Well, I think as a woman, I could say this. It's always been the kitchen and having an open floor plan where they can, a mom can watch the kids play and hang out while she's cooking has been always the number one driver for people to make that decision. And of course, also bathroom and closet space. But now with the pandemic, it's really about having space for the ability to have a home office so they can work remote and have the ability to do so quietly. They also want space that could be designated for children who might have to work, do online schooling at home. And the outdoor space has become very important. If you look at the demand for pools, is just skyrocketed. And that, you know, pool sales are up north of 60 to 80% year over year, but there's not enough homes that have pools. So if builders are putting in pools, they could charge a significant premium, anywhere from $25,000 to $50,000 more on a starter home if they put in a pool.
So this, what you're talking about, this kind of arrangement, this kind of use of space, this is not necessarily temporary because people may end up working from home for the long term. And kids may, you know, like education these days is going more and more online. It's a less expensive way to get a college education as well, although you miss out on socialization and such. But let me get to the inventory now. You had mentioned inventories being at record lows. Now, does that mean that housing is going to be harder to find and more expensive to buy? Or it sounds like you were alluding to a home construction boom. Is that happening?
Well, there's guardrails around a construction boom because we have local municipalities that are short-staffed. There's development that has to happen, and there's constraints around development, just again, from labor. As you may recall, prior to the pandemic, we were really suffering from labor shortage. That might change as we see industries that are not doing well start to shift towards residential construction. But I'd say there's natural guardrails in place that will regulate the growth for any type of real, boom in new development. But at the same time, you know, I do think, unfortunately, that prices are only going to go higher, which will reduce affordability. And I think that you're going to see in certain cities, you're going to have winners and losers, I should say markets. Because if you go and look at what's occurred in 2010 to 2020, we had states like Idaho, Nevada, Utah, Texas, Carolinas growing at a double-digit pace in terms of population growth rate and household growth rate. But then you had states like Pennsylvania, Connecticut, New York, Illinois that didn't really grow. It was flat to up 2%, 3% for a full decade. So there's a migration in this country that's been already underway to more favorable climates and to lower cost places in this country. And so I think that you're going to find that's where builders are going to be building the most. So if you are going to think about waiting and thinking there could be a correction in home prices because of the pandemic, you might get a correction in the tri-state area, for example, as the vaccination came to fruition and people are, you know, able to work remote. Why work in New Jersey or Connecticut or Westchester if you can go move to Florida or go move to Nashville or go move to Austin? So I think you're going to see there's going to be winners and losers, but I think home prices are poised to do nothing but rise further, at least in those fastest growing markets. I was fascinated to learn through one of our resale broker contacts that is really focused in the New England area, and they should have telling me that they had homes that were sitting for years, like homes in the several million dollar price point in Greenwich, Connecticut. And there was really a tale of two markets where the luxury price point was really weak, although it only accounts for, let's say, 5% of transactions. There really was a very weak market for very high luxury. And because of the pandemic, there is an unbelievable recovery going on. And that's been, you know, homes that are priced in that 3 to 5 million that are selling in some cases multiple bids. I don't believe that's sustainable. And I think if we get a house, we get a stock market correction with the turmoil around the election and so much uncertainty, I think that you might start to see that the luxury market could weaken if the stock market rolls over. We also worry about forbearance periods being ending, I'm sorry, and therefore that being a risk for certain areas where consumers right now have the ability not to pay their mortgage. When that period expires after 12 months, there might be some challenges. But in general, I think that it's really about what markets you're looking at, where there are going to be winners and where there's going to be losers. Right now, I put New York City as the biggest loser on my list, and unfortunately, I have an apartment in New York, so I say that with a heavy heart.
Biggest loser because people, well, there was the hot spot. A lot of people already left because they were feeling like the city was too hot. But they had a lot of trouble lately. They have a terror attack, then you got a pandemic, and there's some other things going on there. Go ahead.
Prior to the pandemic, I think New York City was already seeing weakness in the luxury price points, and there was too much new development. But, you know, at the lower price points, you know, you were seeing very strong overall activity. But because of the mayor making the decision to defund the police by $1 billion, social unrest, again, urban deurbanization related to lifestyle, family formation, and then the pandemic to be, ability to work remote. I think right now, and all the data that we aggregate on a monthly basis, New York City is the weakest market in the country, and the condo market generally is weaker, but nowhere is as weak as New York is, both rental and for sale on condo.
Wow, that's big. That's big. The industry, when it's hot, it's gotten in trouble with mortgage underwriting in the past, at least in the recent past it did. Do you have any concerns about that going forward?
Right now, because of Dodd-Frank's requirement, the ability to repay QM that was implemented in January of 2014, it's really put guardrails in place to mitigate sort of the craziness that we saw back in the last housing boom period. And I think the underwriting is much more high quality, prudent underwriting. With the elimination of the back end mortgage debt to income ratio, now with CFPB making that change as the expiration of QM comes to fruition, there's risk that there could be some more riskier underwriting that comes to fruition. But as of right now, we do a survey, and I'd say that, mortgage credit availability is actually tightened during this pandemic, modestly, but I would say that the mortgage originators are much more, concerned about doing anything that would put them in the same position that they were during the Great Bust, where they unfortunately had so many loans put back to them. So there's a fear of regulation and loans put back. So they're really operating within a pretty, safe, prudent credit box as of right now.
So during this whole pandemic, there's certain property types that have really taken a hit. Retail sound is, this is the sound of a car crash. Office has a big question mark over. Is office going to come back as it did before with the same size footprints and so on? Industrial warehouse has done very well. And it sounds like what you're saying is the housing market has done just fine or very well. I mean, how would you grade it during the pandemic?
Well, the housing market during the pandemic was really a story of two halves, because initially during the shutdown, the housing market was pummeled like everything. And we saw, activity decline 50, 60, 70%. But as the economy reopened and mortgage rates continued to fall, now I'd grade the housing market. So it got a big F initially, and now I'd give it a grade of an A plus, and across the board, with the exception, again, of New York City and condos.
Can housing continue to grow in the face of what we hear is surging unemployment? If people are losing their jobs, how does housing continue to grow?
Well, I think housing has some constraints around it, which really we talked about inventory as a big driving constraint. You also have, again, the natural regulators of not being able to build it fast enough and just labor deficits and things of that nature, shortages, But I also think it's all about mortgage rates. So if you told me, Mike, that mortgage rates were going to stay low between now and the end of 2022, I think housing would be a relative winner, because I think that the catalyst to get people into homes, and again, depending on how they're allocating their income and they're spending less elsewhere, even though we can have, 30 plus million people that are right now receiving unemployment benefits, you have, call it another 100 million people that are, you know, gainfully employed and have the income. So I think it's a lot to do with sustainability of rates and recognizing that without a vaccination, the housing will remain center stage. And I think growth will continue to be better than people are anticipating, but we'll see that growth rate start to decelerate because of the natural guardrails that I've highlighted.
So is the housing market's current strength, is that based on residual momentum? And if that's the case, how long is it sustainable, or is it not really residual momentum we're seeing right now?
I don't think it's residual momentum. I don't think it's a pull forward. I think it's people that are, again, focused on their safety, their wellness, and they're looking at how they're spending their income and reallocating it. And you're hearing about it from builders and from brokers, from their discussions with their sales force, and hearing about the stories of people that are now making decisions that they were unable to make prior. So an example of this, the client of mine who works for a hedge fund in Chicago, his wife never wanted to leave the city. They have three young kids, and they decided to move to Austin because his hedge fund will allow him to work from wherever he wants. So they're literally, they bought some land, and they're going to build a house, and their in-laws are following, and maybe even his parents are going to follow. So just an example of, you know, a new buyer, and I can give you 100 more like that, but I do believe that the remote work is the sea change. And remote working, even prior to the pandemic, was about 5% of the labor force worked remotely, and I think that that could quadruple over the course of the next 10 years, as employers are so efficient right now and productive. But there are employees that like to go to an office. So I don't think they'll abandon offices completely. I think there'll be industries that really you can't accommodate remote work, like home builders can't have their people building houses remotely. So there's some industries that just are better positioned to have remote work as an option. And for those industries, I think that they'll continue to see gravitate to more flexibility, and it will reduce their costs from not having to have as much significant office space. So the key change is remote work.
Got it. So how will, and in fact, you may have just answered this question, how will the psychology of home building change after the coronavirus pandemic? It sounds like the change has happened, but do you see some follow-on changes as well?
Well, actually, I'm glad you asked that because I should have mentioned it. It's just been incredible to watch the builders shift into gear to selling virtually. And whether, you know, initially because you were by state orders not able to go visit model homes, and although builders were allowed to still sell, they had to do so virtually. Well, many of them have continued to see through their technology investments, some are well ahead of others, that consumers and especially millennials prefer to do everything online, and it reduces, you know, customer friction. And what we're seeing is a tremendous amount of activity through technological platforms that people are doing everything online, including getting a contract and a deposit made online as if you were going to Amazon and sticking your house in your cart. And that, I mean, I don't think it would have happened had it not been for the pandemic to the extent it's happening. I know, like Lennar, for example, was a leader in providing, you know, less friction to the consumer and doing digital marketing and had a technological platform. But now all of them are really shifting into gear. Those that are lagging are investing quickly. Others are taking advantage of it. So it's really a sea change for the builders. And I think consumers are finding that they could do all their homework. They could do a lot of aspects. They can tour virtually. They can do it with someone, without somebody. I actually had one of the builders record a call with me, and I was acting as the prospective buyer. And you could see the facilities, you could see the community rec center, you could see the areas for fitness and the parks and the walking trails. Like, they literally walk you through everything virtually. If you wanted someone, you could do it on your own. So that's really an important element that this has resulted in, a very positive silver lining for the builders.
You know, I had to laugh because you mentioned, the shopping cart at Amazon. I could just hear the Zillow executives around the country wailing about, what do you mean Amazon? Zillow's the organization
that will
be doing that. I mean, they're working hard in that direction as it is. What about
The builders have their own cart, so you don't have to do anybody. Every individual builder, if you go to their website, they're putting the functionality that you could put it in their cart. So whether you're going to Taylor Morrison, Meritage, Lennar, D.R. Horton. I'm saying each of them. It's not, I was just using Amazon as sort of the analogy, but they have their own functionality, capability technologically to do it without anybody's help.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. They these templates or these platforms. Yeah, and then it's just kind of, it's a white label platform. It's like you need a platform, here it is. Now you can do it all on your own. You don't have to go to some centralized clearinghouse or what have you. So American homeowners and buyers have a tradition of being really nomadic here in the United States. Although I had heard in recent years that's really tailed off. But now what I'm hearing from you is it sounds like Americans are on the move. And I was going to ask about, you know, what drives those moves, but it sounds like it has everything to do with remote working, being able to be virtual companies, and wanting to a different lifestyle. I mean, how would you summarize it?
Well, I think it's important that we address that the move rate in the United States had been under pressure prior to the pandemic. So if you look at 1998 to 2002, the move rate in the United States was at 14.9%. Fast forward 2013 to 2018, the move rate was only at 10.8%. And so it really was under pressure. And the two primary drivers, number one, was that people were choosing not to upgrade for a discretionary purchase. And the second one was the aging population. Because we hear a lot about the millennials, but don't forget that the boomers were a much even bigger generation from the prior generation. They were a 53% increase from their prior generation versus the millennials were a 14% increase from their prior generation of Generation X. So the boomers are roughly 70 million in total. And what the boomers do actually have much more of an impact on the economy. So boomers have been aging in place. So depending on your age, I'll say it, full disclosure, 54 years old. In my 50 to 55 cohort, 9% of consumers in my age group will move in a given year. As compared to those that are ages 20 to 24, 53% will move in a given year. What's happening now is that people in my cohort are now saying, you know what? I can leave the home that I've been in and actually go to a different part of the country and be able to work remotely. Or guess what? I've been stuck in this house for 4 or 5 months. And I am so tired of looking at my family room or my kitchen, and I want that discretionary upgrade now. So I think the move rate is going to start increasing, and I think that we are just in the beginnings, in the first inning of that. I don't know if it's going to get back to 14.9, Mike, but I do think mobility is going to be on the rise. And what keeps mobility rising further is, again, rates. Because when you're locked in at a 30-year fixed rate of 3% and rates were to move up, which doesn't seem likely, but if they were, you're not going anywhere because mortgage rates are not transferable.
So you are actually kind of part of this, are you not? You are in you're on the phone with me right now from Cleveland, Ohio, but you have an apartment in New York. Okay, so you can do what you do from anywhere. Cleveland, despite people calling it the mistake by the lake, I have talked to people in Cleveland who live and work there who say it's a great place. It's the what you get for your money there, the culture, there's professional sports, there's concerts and so on and so forth. So it sounds like you made a conscious decision to do exactly that. Is that the case?
Well, first, Cleveland is not a mistake by the lake. It's a wonderful place to raise a family and, as you pointed out, a very affordable place to live. And go Buckeyes. My husband might have a heart attack if the Buckeyes don't play in the fall. He actually said he wanted to move back to Cleveland to be near his family, his mom and dad, but he really wanted to be close to his alma mater and go to tailgate and go to football games. But honestly, I think for us, we're one child away from being empty nesters out of three. And I would just say that having the city apartment in the city was an idea that, you know, maybe we'd sell this house. I don't know where we would go. The city was one place we contemplated, but maybe also a more favorable climate. So we're still not sure where we'll wind up, but we are very grateful to have a house that would cost five times what it costs in New York City right now or in the tri-state area that we own in Cleveland, Ohio, where we have a lot of space and a lot of outdoor room, and we get to really chill and be holed up here and working remote. But with that, Mike, I got to jump. But
I got just three more questions. How about if you put them on hold? I got just three more questions, Ivy. We can do them rapid fire. Apartments have been on fire. If I'm listening to you right now, I'm thinking the apartment sector might start to soften up because single-family homes are about to take off. True or false?
Correct. True. Keep going.
Okay. What geographies are poised to outperform? Now, you already said New York City's got a bloody nose. Who's going to do great? What geographies are going to do great?
Mountain states, southeast and central area. I mean, everywhere, but I'd say anywhere where there's affordability and, you know, thinking about areas like California and the coastal market, as well as New York, are going to be the unfortunate losers.
Final question. Just give us your overall outlook for the housing market. What's in a nutshell, your summary for the housing market over the next, say, 2 to 5 or 7 years?
Housing is a relative winner, and housing will do well, and people should diversify and put their money, take their money out of the stock market after this massive run and buy some real estate.
Ivy Zelman of
Zelman
and Associates. She's I don't even have to say it. You heard her. She's an expert.
Oh, Ivy, thank you. Mike, one thing I should tell everyone, if you're listening, we're hosting our 2020 virtual housing summit. And if you'd like to go to our website, ZelmanAssociates.com, you're welcome to register. It's 3 days where we do a presentation on the state of the nation of housing. We have top executives that will join me, as I'll be the moderator, on panels across all of the various silos within the housing ecosystem. And we've got Mark Zandi from Moody's. We have Barry Habib from MBS Highway. And we have Jay Smith Walker, who's with Contour Consulting, to talk about consumer behavior. So please register, enjoy it. And I think it's a great way to stay ahead of the curve and have strategic planning or benefit from strategic planning. So welcome
Zelman
to
Associates.
Anyone who wants to register.
ZelmanAssociates.com is the place to go. Ivy, thank you very much. We'll talk
soon. All right. Take care. Thanks, Mike.
Ciao.